Welcome to Practical Mathematics. I'm Jim Osful, and I'll be teaching this course, at least I'll be doing the lecturing. And what the course is going to boil down to is looking at some elements of mathematics. Some of this is going to be review for all of you. For some of you, all of it's going to be review, but it's the practical stuff that you're going to need day to day, potentially at least. And trying to be practical with it, I'm going to use the math that I teach you to look at dealing with day-to-day things that you might encounter that will particularly be financial things. And in doing that, we'll take occasional time to look at how to use a spreadsheet to achieve certain goals that you may need, particularly for those of you that have a business. Now, I know there's a lot of good business software out there you can get for nothing that'll allow you to do all of this, but we'll still show you how to do it on a spreadsheet in case you want to keep the stuff kind of on your machine and not publicly available or available as easily to hackers. And since we're dealing with money, finance, things like that, we'll also take the time to look at biblical instruction concerning different aspects of handling money. But the first thing we're going to do is we're going to start looking at decimal fractions and money. Now, the two go together. Most currencies are decimal currencies. Like the euro, you'd have 3.75 euros, or the American or Canadian dollar, or even the Australian dollar, $5.37, or 37 1/100ths of a dollar. So it all kind of ties in. And let's begin with fractions, decimal fractions, and look at what we know. Okay? So we know numbers like this. I'm a math freak. I'd call this an integer. Most people just call them regular numbers. And you know how they're set up. That's the ones digit, 3 times 1. Off to the left, that's a tens digit, 7 times 10. The next digit off to the left, the hundreds digit, 5 times 1,000. And of course, you move further to the left as you go from 100 to 1,000 to 10,000 to 100,000, etc. on forever. Now you can look at this in a couple of different ways. As you move to the left, the multiplier of the digit is 10 times the previous multiplier, the digit immediately to the right. Or you can look at it the other way. As you move to the right, the multiplier of your digit is 1/10 of the multiplier of the digit immediately to the left. So what happens is we move to the left of the ones digit? Well, first of all, to keep from being confused as to where the ones digit is, you need to have a mark there. We call it a decimal point. Here in the United States, and the way my computer is set up, that's basically a period. In some places, that decimal point will actually be a little higher. It'll be about halfway up the digits. But with that said, as you move to the left of the ones digit, you start getting a decimal fraction. So you'll get something that looks like this, and the part in red, the 7218, is your decimal or decimal fraction. So here's how it works. That 2, that's a tens digit, 2 times 10. The 3, the ones digit, 3 times 1. 7, that's the tenths digit, 7 times 1/10. The 2, the 1/100th digit, 2 times 1 over 100. That 1 is the 1,000th digit, 1 over 1,000. The 8 would be the 10,000th digit. Man, that's hard to say. And if you went on, it would be the 100,000th, the millionths, etc. All as far as you want to go, or as you have to go to solve the problem. So now we know what a decimal looks like. We have to look at adding and subtracting these things. Now let's go back to what we know, adding just plain old integers. So when you're adding them up, or for that matter, when you're subtracting them, you stack them one above the other one. You don't stack it like this. That isn't going to work. Obviously, that's a total waste of time as well. You'll never get that done. You stack them up like this. So now, as you can see right up here, you've got the ones digit. All of those are in line. The tens digit, they're all lined up. Hundreds digit, thousands digit, everything's lined up. And then you can proceed to add. Now you'll notice there's an empty space here, and there's a lot of empty spaces here, 3 of them. we all know that implicitly that empty space is a zero. It's so-called leading zero. We don't bother writing those down. We know they're there. We just work around that and don't worry about it. So what are you going to do if this is a decimal fraction? How about adding those four things together? You're going to line them up like that? Well, of course you're not. That's no better. That's not going to work either. Here's what works. The decimal points here are lined up like that. The ones are lined up. The tens are lined up. The hundreds are lined up. If you had them, the thousands, the ten thousands, etc. Here at the decimal point, the next one is the 1/10, the 1/100, the 1/1000th digit, and they're all lined up. And here's a 10,000th digit. And you'll notice there's a lot of empty spaces here. Those are the implicit trailing zeros. I mean, if you do arithmetic, you carry a whole head full of spare zeros. You can toss them in when you need them. I don't bother tossing them in. If you like them there, fine. I don't need them. But you just add them up like they were zeros. And of course, the same trick for subtracting. You just line up the decimal point and subtract it like you would any other number, realizing that you may have implicit trailing zeros. No problem. How about multiplying decimal fractions? How do you do this one? Now, the first thing you'll notice is I've not lined this up by the decimal point. Let's just ignore the decimal point for the minute. Pretend it's not there. So we've got 7 times 24. There's that. 0 times 24 would act like a tens digit if we're ignoring that decimal point. So we put in the 0 and, well, a couple of zeros there since it's a big nothing. Then 3 times 24, but that's 300. So you put in your two zeros and put your leading 72 in. Add that all up and you've got 7,368. No, that's not right. We have to make room for the decimal point. So where do we put that? Well, if you look at this, there's one decimal point on 2.4. There's two digits to the right of the decimal point on 3.07, so that's three of those. And the correct thing to do is get down to the answer, count in three decimal places from the right, put your decimal place after that third one. Done deal. That is a correct answer. And yes, I did check that on my calculator, but I knew it ahead of time anyway. So now the next trick is dividing decimal fractions. So you've got this horrible thing, 22.46732, and we're going to divide that by 3.191. I mean, we set it up like any regular long division, but this looks horrid. So let's move the decimal points. If I do it on the divider, I have to do it to the thing I'm dividing it into to get the same answer. So let's do that. We get this, pardon the small font, and we just start dividing it like it was any other digit. So let's see here. Okay, about a 7 there. Leaves 130. I'm going to have to bring down two digits. So you'll notice where the decimal point went. Right over the other decimal point. And we had to put a 0 in because we dropped the 3. That wasn't big enough, so we dropped the 2. 4 times that, we can do that. We got left over 2.68. We're going to have to bring down two zeros. Now, I mentioned keeping a pocket full of zeros available to you, and we get 7.0408, and it'll go on and on as long as you're willing to put up with it. Essentially, forever. But most of the time, we're dealing with currency, which means all I need is two decimal places. Okay, now what? The answer is we round it. Rounding is pretty simple. You figure out how many decimal places accuracy you need. For money, it would be 2. For other applications, some engineering applications perhaps, or other things you're doing, and I've had to work in 24 and 25 digit arithmetic on occasion. Boy, that's a pain. But you decide how many decimal places you need, count that many decimal places out, okay, and look at the digit just to the right of the last decimal place you need. If that digit is less than 5, just throw the rest away. Leave it alone. Pretend it doesn't exist. If it's 5 or more, then that last digit you need, increase it by 1, and then get rid of the rest. Does that introduce an error in the calculations? Yeah, it does. But compared to what you need, the error is small and generally is tolerable. Now, how do you convert fractions into decimals? Let's take 5/16. Okay, 16 doesn't divide into 5. Set it up. You'll notice I've thrown in a bunch of zeros. So 0. Now let's see, that'd be 48. Let's see, that'll only go in once. Let's see here, that'll go in twice. Oh, we'll just finish it out, and it comes to exactly 0.3125, which, frankly, I knew in advance. I've done this before. So it's a nice closed form decimal. Let's try another fraction here. How about 1/7? And I've done it all out for you here. I don't want to put you through it. And I did that second column over here. You'll notice I just pulled it over here because when I did it the other way, the font was so small you couldn't read it. But you'll notice we started out with a 1 here, and we end up with a 1 here. So we're going to get the same sequence of digits, 6 digits long. That'll be the next 6 digits, and the next 6 digits, and the next 6 digits, and, you know, going off the screen, 6 digits. It'll go on forever like that. This is what is called a repeating decimal. Now, you can actually tell you how many decimals to expect in the repeat for any digit or any number you're dividing by. But that's another course in mathematics called number theory. We're not going to touch that here. So, how do you represent these repeating decimals in compact format? Here's the repeat, and you just draw a line over what repeats. And that notation says, and do that sequence forever. Here's 1/3. So you just get a string of 3s. 1/9, you get a string of 1s. 1/11, 09, 09, 09, 09, forever and ever and ever and ever. Nice to know. So there's your infinite repeats. Now, if you're like me, now that we've taken fractions to decimals, you probably would like to know how to take a decimal and make it a fraction. So let's start with the simple stuff, the finite length decimals, okay? So 0.3125, you just take the 3125, one followed by however many zeros there are, which in this case there's 4 digits here, so you put in 4 zeros. And then you divide them by their least or their greatest common divisors, which we'll look at that later. Divide them by that, and you get your 5/16 back. 0.25, 25 over 100, that's 1/4, which I knew that in advance, and so did you. 0.025, 25 over 1,000, that's 1/40. You get the point. It's very easy. Decimals, where you've got an infinite repeat, the repeating 3s, just however long your repeat is, take that many 9s, and then put the repeat over it. So 0.3 is 3 over 9. That, when you get it out, is 1/3. This long mess here, 0.142857, put the 142857 over a half a dozen 9s, you get 1/7. What do you do with something like this? Okay, that's 8.3 over 100, or 8 1/3 over 100. We know that this is 1/3 right here. So multiply both of these times 3 to get rid of that 1/3, and you get 25 over 300, and that reduces down to 1/12. You can do that, frankly, with whatever you've got. Okay, and the 0.3 would be, of course, your 3 over 9, which reduces down to 1/3. And you can do that all you want. So, the next trick we want to look at is looking at money, what it is, and something of its history. Money is like time. I mean, we all know what money is, right? I mean, I know what money is. I got a couple of bucks in my wallet, right? I got some change in my pocket. We all know what it is until we have to define it. That's a little harder. And with time, it's very nearly impossible. But what really is money? And it's something that can serve in a number of different ways. First of all, it can serve as a store of value. What I've got in my wallet, the change that I've got in my pocket, the money I have in my savings account, in my checking account, my debit account, that's all value that's been stored somehow as money. It can be a unit of account. How much have I loaned you? I mean, can you try and figure out, okay, I've loaned you 4 cows and you're going to pay me back in, say, corn or chickens? How do you do that? But if you have an agreed on thing that you use as money, the loan of so and so many of this is equivalent to this amount of money, and then you can pay me back in the equivalent. And of course, it's a medium of exchange. You know, I go to the store, I don't trade 3 dozen eggs for, you know, a can of beans. I give them money. So it's a tool that does all of these things. And different things over the years have been used as money. What is used for money should have certain properties, okay? First of all, it has to be high in replacement cost. It's something that's valuable. We don't use leaves for money. You can replace those very easily. It has to be durable and non-perishable. So on the whole, you probably don't want to use oranges for money because they'll rot. And if you step on them, there goes their value. Something that's going to, well, take a little abuse. And you want something that's convenient to exchange. Right. Trading cows for eggs, really inconvenient. And here are things that have been used for money. Oh my goodness, look at all of those things. You know, and there's a lot more, okay? There's the only two letters of the alphabet that are missing are T and X. And there's a lot more things. I mean, there's all kinds of things that have been used for money. But again, everybody agrees this is what we'll use. So what does money do? What are its main functions? Well, there are some specific functions, and you can read them. There's the concrete stuff, like I said earlier, the medium of exchange, a means of payment, storage of value. Those are all important. But it also has abstract functions, units of account. Money doesn't actually have to physically change hands. You can just put it on a ledger and have it moved around inside that ledger as a unit of account. It's a common measure of value. Right. A car is worth a certain amount of currency. A can of beans is worth a certain amount of currency. A candy bar is worth a certain amount of currency. You use a currency as a standard measure of value. It's also used as a standard for deferred payments, as in, you know, paying off loans or, you know, creating a loan and receiving the money. So you've got that as well. Then there are also some general functions, and those are generally macroeconomic. They're usually quite abstract, but it's a liquid asset, something that you can convert easily into other things. It's a framework of what's called the market allocative system. Hello, in English, that's prices. Sorry. It's a causative factor in the economy. Money is what helps the economy move forward. Okay, and you can use it to control the economy. If the government reduces the money supply, the economy will tend to contract. Or, what they really would rather do is have it expand less rapidly. If they increase the amount of money, the economy will expand more rapidly. So it's a tool, and a useful one at that. And then let's look at a few biblical principles on personal finance as we close this out. First of all, it's not yours in the first place. Money, material goods, everything. It's not yours. God owns it all. That includes me. That includes you. It's all His. We are His stewards. Now, that makes a number of interesting points. As one pastor I was listening to here recently pointed out, God owns the money. The government doesn't own your taxes. God owns that tax, and He's telling you that it is His will you allocate that amount of money He's entrusted to you to the government, because He's choosing to entrust it to that government. Now, I got news for you. You are not responsible for what the government does with your money. It's not your money anyway, remember? It's God's money. You're not responsible for that. Yes, governments will do things that we as Christians will object to, that we will find offensive. But our responsibility is to do what we are required and expected to do by the magistrates or government that God is appointing over us. God put it there. So that gives you an input based on it's not mine anyhow. How God has it distributed is His to control. Number two, we've got to recognize our responsibility. Look, we're stewards. These are all God's resources. We need to be pretty sure we're using them as He would have us do, and use them in a responsible manner. How does that mean for your culture? I guess that's something that you and the Lord need to talk about. I can't talk for any culture but mine, and frankly, I can't really talk for anybody but me. But use them responsibly, and if you're talking about big chunks of money, maybe put some time in praying, asking the Lord what we need to do. Remember God first. Let's face it, He owns it all. You kind of need to remember that since He owns it all, we need to be sure what He wants to do. Now, the first thing He has in mind when He gives us financial resources or any other is to provide for us as an individual, to allow us to provide for our families, spouse, maybe children, but also maybe parents that need help, blood kin of other sorts. But first and foremost, we do need to remember that we're given what we have, and we're expected to remember the source, which is God, and what He wants done with it, which involves His kingdom. So He gets the first cut of our paychecks and our resources. We need to rein in our spending. You know, this involves cutting back on frivolities, okay? Maybe not so many stops at that coffee shop in a week. Maybe not owning endless access to that online gaming thing. Maybe not spending as much time doing it, even though you do that. Maybe just not as often at the coffee house. Again, that's between you and the Lord. Not mine to tell you. But it also includes avoiding a lavish lifestyle. Do you really need a great big huge van? A lot of people do. Got a lot of kids. Or maybe you use it for transporting people in your ministry. But do you really need it if you're not doing something like that? I mean, it's something to look at. You need to think about reining in your spending. Stick to what's needed. Yes, you're allowed to enjoy things on top of that, but let's not go overboard. And where overboard is, like I said, that's between you and God, not you and me. Ready your future. Someday down the road, you may not be able to work. Someday you might lose your job, and it may take you a while to get it. Plan ahead. Prepare. Build a cushion for emergencies. Save for that retirement. You know, If your refrigerator explodes on you, it's kind of nice to have a cushion, some money put by for that emergency. Medical disasters happen. You could get hit by a truck. You could get appendicitis. You could get pneumonia. Who knows what all could happen? You have a deductible on your medical insurance. Even in many countries where you have socialized medicine, there's still some fiscal responsibility. Know what that is. Prepare for it in case you need it. There's a loss of work. Prepare for that in case it's needed. Unions will strike. Have money put aside so that you don't have to be looking for somebody to help you out. Prepare ahead and respect others. That money's not just there for you and yours. Prosperity is given to me so that I can bless you by recognizing your need and helping to meet that need. Does that mean every unaccounted for dollar I've got needs to go to somebody else? Not necessarily. Maybe it needs to go into savings so that I don't have a need. But maybe that savings I've got, when my friend has an issue that was beyond what he had prepared for, maybe that money's there to help that out. It's something you need to keep thinking about. Because remember, read that top line again and remember it well. It's not yours in the first place. It's all God's, and we are responsible to handle it the way He needs us to handle it. So, thank you for putting up with me. See you in our next little lecture on practical mathematics.